Good evening. Welcome to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I am Sean Yoz, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Friday. Support for WEAA is provided by ADT. More information available at ADT.com. Coming up in the second hour of the show, the world famous happy hour. It is the supernova and the volcano together. Navasha Dea, Lafayette Gilchrist, they came together on Lafayette's new album, New Urban World Blues. They're going to be both in the studio with me, two great internationally acclaimed musicians on the world famous happy hour coming up in the second hour. You don't want to miss it. We're going to play all of the tracks from Lafayette's new CD, and we'll play some of my favorites from both Lafayette and Navasha's career. So you do not want to miss the world famous happy hour coming up in the second hour of First Edition. A little bit later in the first hour, the Mod Squad will be here. That's Stephen Janis and Taya Graham of the Real News Network reporting on politics and crime, including a, unfortunately, tragically, an extremely violent night last night in Baltimore. I believe 3 homicides, many shootings. So we'll get down to the bottom of that with Stephen Janis and Taya Graham, the Mod Squad. But before we get to the Mod Squad, it is the 125th anniversary of the Afro-American newspaper. And we have put together, the Afro has put together a commemorative edition commemorating 125 years of continuous publication of the number one, the best newspaper, best black newspaper in America. Kamal High is the managing editor of the Afro, and he's in the studio with me. Kamal, welcome back.
Thank you, Sean. Good to be here.
Good to have you. Before we begin delving into the pages of this commemorative issue, let's tell the listeners to make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share with the people unless you don't want me to. And, of course, I won't. Now, back to 125 years.
It's been a long time coming.
A long time coming, brother. And man, kudos to you and Josette Marshburn for putting this together, this commemorative issue. It's literally breathtaking.
Yes, it's 60 pages, and thank you for your contributions as well. You helped pick out some of those archive stories that we have in there. Yes, there was a team of people that put together these 60 pages where we delve into not only the history of what's been going on for the past 125 years, but also, you know, we give you a little insight into the Afro. You know, we've got some stories about not only our reporters, but some of the people, the support staff who helped make the Afro what it is.
I'm literally, because this is like the first time that I've actually really started looking at it. I mean, obviously, yeah, I dug into the archives and helped pull out a few stories, but this is American history.
Yes, I mean, it's really, I mean, you can really sort of sink into the archives at the Afro, because we have covered some amazing, terrifying, and exciting things. I mean, from eyewitness accounts of lynchings to our sports reporters hanging out with, you know, Jackie Robinson and Muhammad Ali. You know, we've been everywhere. We haven't done everything, but, you know, sometimes it feels that way.
Yeah. So I think the best way to do this is just to go section by section and talk a little bit about each section. As for people who don't know, the Afro was founded in 1892,
yes,
by Reverend John Murphy Sr.
Yes, a former slave.
Yeah, I mean, founded 20, oh, not even, wait a minute, about 20 some odd years out of slavery, literally.
Yes, he borrowed $200 from his wife, Martha, I believe, to buy the essentially a newspaper that was already existing, and he took it over and made it into his own, ultimately merging with another newspaper to become the Afro.
Yeah, it was a church newspaper, I believe.
Yes, the Afro started in Mount Shiloh Baptist Church here in Baltimore.
Now, I didn't know that. I didn't know that it actually started at Shiloh. That's fascinating.
Yes, in the basement. They were cranking it out.
Yeah. And so from 1892 until today, we've been publishing continuously. But in this first section is from 1892 to 1917. You know, Jake Oliver said something.
Our publisher.
Yes, Jake Oliver, the publisher of the Afro. He said something that I hadn't thought about. He said in the early years after slavery, there was some hesitancy on the part of many black people in America as far as trying to really secure equal footing or equality in this country, because the fear was not that far out of slavery that America could re-enslave.
Yes, I mean that, you know, sort of similar to the way in the days after Jim Crow ended, you know, people were like, well, maybe they may bring it back. And, you know, right after slavery ended, the amount of African-Americans who could read was obviously a limited pool. So John H. Murphy Sr. was truly taking a risk with starting a newspaper that was aimed at African-Americans.
Absolutely. But I guess, and I don't know this empirically, but what I do know empirically is that Baltimore had the largest black ex-slave population or free population in the United States, and perhaps that energy that was in the city at that time maybe led to his decision along with his wife. So many times the wife gives the husband the money.
That's right.
To get it done.
You can't forget our black women.
No, not at all. But it's breathtaking just to look at the pictures.
Yes, and the thing is, when the Afro first started, back in 1892, pictures were a rarity in the newspaper. So in our early editions, there are very few pictures because it was expensive, it was time consuming to transfer to newspaper. So there's a lot of sort of closely written text, but we managed to sort of pull out some of the more compelling items. Like for example, there's one where Booker T. Washington went to the White House under Teddy Roosevelt, and this caused a stir.
It was a scandal. Really.
Yes, people were clutching their pearls, catching the vapors. People were astonished that an African American would be at the White House, and like, what was this Roosevelt fellow doing?
And I think Roosevelt's response, at least to somebody, was that there can never be another, Negro, but I think he said something else.
Yes.
Eating at the White House after this, because the uproar in white America was that virulent in response to Booker T. Washington dining, becoming the first black man ever to eat inside of the White House.
It's funny and it's sad to think about today, because, you know, just the idea that the president of the United States of America would be like, we can't have this race in the White House. They might sully it. Yeah. You know, sort of, you know, you go, that's not very nice of you.
No. Talk about, Kamau, the process of sorting out and organizing all of these stories, because, I mean, 125 years is a long time, and there's
yes.
a lot. How many stories have been written in the Afro? I've personally written thousands, so there must be about literally a million stories in the length of time that the Afro has existed. A million stories.
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, it's astonishing how much content we truly have. I mean, all thanks go out to Gisette Marshburn, the former Afro archivist who now works at the Smithsonian, who did a yeoman's amount of work in pulling together. And the way we decided to handle it was by splitting it into sections, different eras. I mean, they roughly track the different publishers of the Afro, because each publisher has always put their stamp on the Afro.
Absolutely true. One more. Let's talk about the work of Ida B. Wells chronicled in this edition. Southern Horrors, the Lynch Law in all its phases. I think that's Ida B. Wells. I'm pretty sure.
Yes. I mean, Ida B. Wells was a well-known journalist back in those days, and one of the things that she is known for is chronicling the lynchings in America.
Absolutely.
Because at the time, One, they were considered so common as to not be newsworthy in most white-aimed newspapers. So the idea of sort of writing about each and every one of them and trying to put together, like, well, how many of these things are happening? How often does this happen? Where does it happen? Was revolutionary at the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. A woman whose accomplishments were incredible and sometimes gets caught up in the shadows of history, but really made an amazing contribution to our community early on in those in the late 1800s and into the early 1900s. Let me ID real quick. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. I'm in the studio with Kamau High. He is the managing editor of the Afro newspaper, the number one black newspaper in the country. And we are talking about the 125th anniversary issue, the Afro celebrating 125 years of continuous publication. And we have put together an amazing, and I mean amazing, issue, 60 pages this week. Go pick it up at your newsstands. Only $5. This is going to be a keepsake. It is going to be a collector's item. So for $5, only $5, you can get this commemorative issue. Really stunning when you look at the fact that we have covered 125 years of history in this country. So the next section is when the Afro comes onto the national stage, and it did in a prominent way from 1917 to 1942.
Yes, that was under the direction of Carl J. Murphy.
Yep.
And, you know, what his insight, as many newspaper man has learned, is that sex sells. Scandal sells. People love that kind of stuff. And, you know, I can't blame them. So while the Afro has always been true to its roots of fighting for social justice and, you know, on behalf of oppressed people, we also let our freak flag fly. You know, we let you indulge in the sort of the vicarious experience of listening to other people's conversations and seeing their scandals.
I wonder what Carl Murphy would think about letting his freak flag fly. I don't know.
But hey, listen,
it's all right.
But yeah, so you know, you see more celebrity coverage.
Oh, absolutely.
You see more crime. You see more sex. And then in addition to, you know, sort of what's going on with the churches, the military at the time, the African Americans entering World War I, even though they were in segregated units, people needed news about what was going on with our boys overseas. And the Afro was there to provide all of that.
And the Afro covered extensively World War II.
Oh, yes.
Sent reporters overseas, and specifically covered the contribution of black soldiers and sailors. During World War II, obviously, they returned back to a segregated United States when the thought was, in the minds of many, that the victory in Europe would mean a victory in the United States, and it didn't happen.
No. You could argue that with the order to desegregate the army, that sort of paved the way for much of what we would see coming out of that, where people finally began to see that, oh, maybe, you know, society won't collapse and we all catch cooties if African Americans are given a couple of more rights.
Indeed, indeed. We could take the whole segment and just talk about one section because it's that fascinating. I'm telling you, if you do not go out and buy, I can't make anybody do anything, but if you don't go out and buy this commemorative issue of the Afro newspaper chronicling the 125 years of continuous publication for $5, you're really missing something. And I'm being honest. I'm not just selling here. I'm saying as a fan and lover of history, this is sensational.
Yes, you know, it's fascinating because, you know, in putting this issue together, we went back to when we celebrate our 120th anniversary and our 110th anniversary, and we tried to pull things that were always notable and interesting, but that weren't quite as, you know, sort of standard issue, shall we say, when you think of African American history. While yes, obviously we have to have coverage of Dr. King and Rosa Parks, we also tried to highlight other African Americans and their contribution to the civil rights struggle.
To that point, and this may go beyond the scope of the civil rights struggle, but I think this is really important that we noted that the contribution of Joe Gans, a Baltimorean, really became the first black world boxing champion of the 20th century. A lot of people miss out on who Joe Gans was, but he was a Baltimorean, and it's important to, if you don't know about him, delve into his history. Fascinating character. And really kind of created the template for the black world champion, boxing champion, that includes Muhammad Ali, Jack Johnson, and all the rest.
Yes, and actually, speaking of Muhammad Ali, we actually put together a full page on him, where we just sort of, you know, we chronicle his championship fights, knocking out Joe Lewis,
Joe Frazier didn't knock him out, but beat him 2 out of 3 times. Especially the thrill in Manila.
Yes. But also, you know, sort of his controversy with refusing to be drafted and then taking that fight all the way to the Supreme Court, you know, and also that he's had a couple of marriages in there. Or he had a couple of marriages.
He definitely had a few marriages. I think Alani was his fourth.
Yes,
wife.
I believe he went up to 4. Yeah. And then, of course, you know, his conversion to the Nation of Islam and sort of, again, there was a lot of pearl clutching back in those days when that happened, when a man just decided to pick a different religion.
Well, when a black man who talks as much as Muhammad Ali did and nobody could beat him, I mean, they had to try to pick at something, and they took the prime years of his life because he refused to be inducted into the services during the Vietnam War. So check out the full page on Muhammad Ali in this commemorative issue, this 125th anniversary issue of the Afro. Let's go to the Afro coverage. This is where the magic really happened for us, I think. The Afro coverage of Jim Crow from 1942 to 1967.
Yes, I mean, that's the era of, you know, the murder of Emmett Till. That's when you've got Jackie Robinson, you know, breaking the color barrier along with Ray Campanella. That's when you've got the rise of people like Josephine Baker. And that's when you've also got African-Americans truly sort of moving forward in the military and taking more and more high-level positions. And then also, of course, the Montgomery bus boycott and sort of the importance of that and the role that played in sort of not only organizing African Americans, but sort of making people realize that, you know, Jim Crow, he's got to go.
Yeah. Josephine Baker. Wow.
Yes. I was actually surprised. I did not realize that Josephine Baker at the time adopted 11 children.
Yeah, the Rainbow Tribe.
You know, so Angelina Jolie, she still got work to do.
Yeah, with the Rainbow Tribe. She was a phenomenal entertainer and humanitarian. Let's come up into A Time of Turmoil and Triumph from 1967 and 1992.
Yes, that is, of course, where we see Dr. King killed. We see then the subsequent riots in places such as Baltimore, Detroit, and many places in America. And then that's also the rise of crack cocaine and AIDS,
yeah.
both of which have had and continue to have devastating effects on the African-American community. And that is also the time, this is one of my favorite stories that we picked out. It's when the celebrities began working on We Are the World. At the time, the song did not have a title. They just knew that Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie, and a variety of other people were involved, and they were trying to do something. And, you know, We Are the World is what came out of it. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Look at that.
Absolutely. Looking at this page, the Muhammad Ali page. Look at that.
Yes, and that's also it also has a picture of Eartha Kitt and the wife of Lyndon Johnson, because Eartha Kitt was invited to the White House, and while she was there, she read Lyndon Baines Johnson about segregation. And
this look of consternation on Lady Bird's face, like, you know,
yes.
Shut up.
Yes.
Wow,
yes.
Look at that.
So there was no shade in Eartha's game. She just straight up told him, like, listen. Come on now.
They invited her to the White House and she read them up and down. I love it.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of fun and interesting and compelling things like that in this issue.
Wow. And then, of course, special section on the rise of the first black president of the United States, the 44th president, Barack Obama.
Yes. We, of course, we gave 3 pages to President Obama for his transformative presidency, you know, when he won, when he was reelected to his second term, and then on his final day in office, we did the page Thank You, Mr. President, where we had many contributors sort of talk about the legacy of Barack Obama.
And also, I'm happy to see that we give dap to two of the greatest that ever did it,
yes.
Prince and Michael Jackson.
Yes, we put a full page of Prince coverage, and then Michael Jackson, when he died, he was on the cover with a lovely essay about sort of his life and career with a stunning photograph. And, you know, and then, of course, that is also the 1992 to today. That is also the time, of course, of the East Coast, West Coast rivalry, which saw the death of Tupac Shakur and the notorious B.I.G.
Right. Also in this one, this issue, the Million Man March, of course.
The Million Man March, the Million Woman March.
Yep.
And then also that this was the time when this was the time of 9/11 and when we invaded Iraq. And also where, if you may remember, when Tiger Woods first came out and defined his race as, what do they call it, Calabasian?
Calabanasian.
Calabanasian.
It's burned into my, it's terribly burned into my skull, that word.
Yes. And then we also, you know, just for fun, because I'm kind of an internet nerd, we have a screenshot of the Afro.com's website from 2003, just to sort of give you a sense of what it was like. And then we included one from today because, you know, 20 years from now, people will look back and go, what did the website look like?
Like a time capsule.
Like a little time capsule. A time capsule of fun.
Yeah. Well, man, well done. Really well done.
Thank you. It was a team effort and we worked very hard on it.
Tell me about it. But really, this is. I mean, I'm halfway speechless because this is a testimony to the incredible work that so many people have done for literally 125 years of continuous publication of this newspaper, the best black newspaper in America. And I may be a bit prejudiced, but not all that much. As an objective lover of history, you don't want to miss this. You don't want to miss this. $5.
Exactly. I mean, you can't beat that with a baseball bat.
Nope. Kamau High is the managing editor of the Afro-American newspaper, number one black newspaper in the country. Kamau, thanks for coming through. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Sean. I'll see you next week.
See you next week. See you next week. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Mod Squad will be here. That is Taya Graham and Stephen Janice of the Real News Network talking about crime and politics, including a disastrous violent night in the city, unfortunately. I believe 3 homicides, several shootings. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Here on WEAA 88.9, I'm Sean Yoes, your host, making the transition from the transcendent 125th anniversary issue of the Afro newspaper to the work of the Mod Squad. They are in the studio. That is Taya Graham and Stephen Janice of the Real News Network. Friends, welcome back.
Thank you, Sean. Really glad to be here.
It's a great issue. I bought a copy, mm-hmm. and the woman at the 7-Eleven was like, everybody's buying it, but it's $5. I don't understand it.
It's really awesome. Is something. It really, I mean, I know that I'm not. I am biased, but
no. But the history, I mean,
the history of the historical value of this is sensational.
And I think you know, you take some of the institutions in this town for granted, and you realize that the Afro's impact on reporting and journalism over the past. It's just I didn't realize it went back that far. It's amazing.
Yep,
it's a treasure.
It really is a treasure. Let's take a couple of phone calls. A couple of people want to have some comments about the Afro's 125th anniversary. Let's go to Dwayne first. Dwayne, you're on First Edition with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Sean, how you know? I've been listening to you for a while, and you're doing very well.
Thank you, brother.
The reason I'm on the call, when I was born, 1951. Last year, my niece has given me this article about my father, Alfonso Tillman. It beat a lot of other people to be into the Eastern Open Forest Golf.
Okay.
And I said, it's not been nothing said about my father, how great he was with golf, because I grew up in Gilmer Plaza in Baltimore, where I was supposed to be poor and this and that. When she showed me, I say, way before Tiger Woods, was my father was one of the great. He beat, I think Sam Snead or whoever was the name. And when I heard about they really, you guys are really doing something about the Afro, and they can't cover it all, the greatness of us as people. And I thought about my father. I said, oh, one of the best really black golf players. He qualified for the Eastern Open. And then it hit me because I saw the picture for him.
Okay.
And I just had to get through to, hey, man, just say something about my dad.
All right. Dwayne, thank you for calling in. We appreciate it. Let's go to Doug Colbert, professor, University of Maryland law professor on the phone. Doug, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Sean.
Hey, man.
How you doing?
All right, brother.
Hey, Mod Squad.
Hey, what's
Hi,
up?
Professor. How you doing?
How are you?
So, Sean, I haven't brought my issue yet, but of course I will. And what I wanted to point out is just how much courage it took in 1892.
Absolutely.
You know, for the original founders of the Afro to publish a newspaper at a point in our nation's history, and most people, I don't think, don't realize what a violent period it was.
Very true.
Particularly following a Supreme Court decision in 1883, which legitimized the removal of federal troops and turned power back to the Southern Confederacy and the slave owners again. And so there was about 2,500 people who were lynched in our country over a 17-year period.
Absolutely.
Between 1883 and 1900. It's like 150 people a day. And to have an Afro publish specifically for the community itself, it just took so much effort and so much bravery to be able to exercise your First Amendment right at that particular part of history. So I just thought that was, you know, a remarkable achievement.
Doug, you make a really important point, and I said that during the segment, the fact that John Murphy Sr. Had the courage and the foresight to borrow the money from his wife, first of all, and begin the newspaper. Just literally, 1892 is less than 30 years out of slavery. The United States, the Emancipation Proclamation, less than 30 years afterwards. And again, 125 years of continuous publication. But you're absolutely right. The courage that it took just to take that step was phenomenal, and we wouldn't be here without that courageous first step that Mr. Murphy took.
And Sean, if I can just add one thing, I don't know, you're being a sports fan, you might really identify with this, but when you were referring to President Roosevelt saying that would be the last time a black person ate in the White House,
right,
and how it outraged the white population, I immediately, and this may be not for everyone, but I immediately thought of the white reaction to Colin Kaepernick, you know, becoming a raven in our city, not being judged on whether he's a good athlete and will help a team, but rather the fact that he had the courage to protest against police brutality, against government action.
Absolutely.
And here the fans who are screaming the loudest, you know, are coming from the white communities because they don't even look at the justification for that. So I just felt like here we are 125 years later and we're still not giving a person the chance to be judged on his merit.
Well, facts when you say that, absolute facts. Doug Colbert is University of Maryland law professor. Doug, thank you for calling in, man. We appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Take care.
All right. I want to let everybody know that you can pick up a copy of the 125th anniversary issue of the Afro. Most CVS stores, many 7-Eleven stores, and other convenience stores are selling it. It's $5 on newsstands. So go out and get your copy of the 125th issue today. Just $5. That's all, $5. So let's move into the Mod Squad segment. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, tragically, a extremely violent night last night in Baltimore City.
Yeah, there were six or seven shootings, three murders, including a man that was shot on York Road, bicycle. Two teens were shot. One was killed, right? Was it one was killed?
I believe an 18-year-old was shot in the forehead.
In the forehead and killed. And then, of course, we had a couple days ago, a 54-year-old man, father of 12, was shot. And then, of course, we had last night, a 69-year-old Hispanic man was shot and killed.
And you also mentioned that a 97-year-old man was
like a week ago, World War II veteran, was stabbed to death in his own house in his pajamas. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's very difficult to talk about things like police reform when the violence. And then, of course, the commissioner gave a very impassioned speech. And one of the things he talked about was there was an accident last night. A young mother was killed by a young man who had been
fleeing the police,
but had been arrested on a gun charge about a year and a half ago in 2015. Was supposed to get a certain minimum sentence, but a lot of the sentence was not commuted, but you know, a certain time served, whatever. Mm-hmm. And he ended up T-boning her car after he evaded police, stopped chasing him. He evaded police and
T-boned
her car.
And then he ran on foot. And I believe he was supposed to have a 3-year sentence for the possession of an illegal handgun.
I mean, I guess
and they
say
said
suspended.
That two years and three months of that sentence was suspended.
Yes.
And it seems that Commissioner Davis has been shooting at the judiciary. In the last couple speeches he's had to the public and to the press, he has really put a great deal of blame and a great deal of pressure on the judiciary for suspending sentences on people who have gone out and reoffended.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he did, it's interesting. He did say, I'm not pointing fingers here. I'm just, you know, I guess expressing frustration. He seemed, I wouldn't say frustrated, but he looked extremely unhappy. Like you see many police commissioners in Baltimore, not to make light of it, when the impossible at nature of the job sort of seems to overwhelm them. But, you know, so that was, I think it was six or seven shootings, including a guy on a bike down on York Road, the 5,000 block of York Road, who was shot during, I guess, what they think was a robbery. I mean, one thing he said was most of these are not random. Mm-hmm. Most of the people have some sort of connection.
You think of the 97-year-old man that was stabbed to death in his bed, in his pajamas, the father of 12 that was
54-year-old father of 12. I mean, you know, I don't know if it was different 30 years ago or 20 years ago, mm-hmm. that if people said, well, we're keep hands off the elderly or something.
Right.
Or, you know, he's a dad, he's got 10 children, we're not going to shoot him. But now, I mean, because it used to be that the narrative was it's, you know, one drug dealer killing another.
Right.
That doesn't sound like what this is about right now. This sounds like a completely different
right.
type of
and
mayhem.
The criticism is just fine. I mean, Build had criticized the mayor. Councilman Brandon Scott had come out with his own violence reduction plan that was, in essence, a criticism of what he considered the mayor's lack of action. Mm-hmm. The FOP, of course, had done everything but call out Commissioner Davis publicly.
I know they're doing a listening tour, too. I wonder how that's going. I haven't heard anything about that.
Who's doing a listening
tour? The FOP was supposed to be going out to, like, different community organizations.
Where are they going?
I don't know. This is just something that came up and then I didn't see any follow through. But I'll find out because that would be interesting.
And then the public has been calling, you know, continuously to fire Commissioner Davis. So I wonder if Mayor Pugh's administration is going to have to sacrifice one of her knights to save the queen, so to speak.
But see, I don't see where firing Davis does you any good. I mean, I don't see where you get anything out of that. I mean, just
I'm not necessarily saying that it would cause the results that people are hoping for. But
like 6 months in, she already fires Commissioner. I'm sorry.
I think I'm basically in agreement with what you're saying, Stephen. I'm not sure what benefit there would be in firing Davis. However, what I hear over and over again is if this commissioner had been a black commissioner, given the fact that there have been how many homicides under Davis's watch?
I mean, you can't even count them because you had
the scandals under his purview.
True.
I mean, people. This is what I mean. I don't think.
No, you
I
make
mean,
a good point. When in 2007, after we had a January of like 45 murders, Ham, and then you had the Gerard Mungo thing, Ham got fired. Yeah. You know.
I mean, think about what has transpired in the last 3 years. I'm not I'm just saying, look at it. If you look at it objectively, I could see why people say, like, why is this guy
still? No, it's a great question.
Right. I mean, I think we're at about 211 murders at this point, which is just putting us on another record year for homicide. Yeah.
So in total, with 344 and 20, I mean, I hate to say it, but I mean, 600, 700, 800, 900, I mean, like 900 under...
Yeah,
right.
under
we have 213 homicide cases, and we have 377 non-fatal shootings, and 46 self-inflicted shootings, 813 aggravated assault, 2,900 cases of robbery, and carjacking.
So the point being that if you take what has transpired as far as homicide is concerned in our city, if you take what has transpired as far as the Baltimore 7 is concerned, as far as these officers being caught on videotape planting evidence, the officer bilking the casino for money, driving his car down to Ocean City.
That's right.
This is all under the watch of Kevin Davis.
Absolutely.
He's not the command staff of Baltimore City Police.
Right.
And a lot of this misconduct really, I believe, emanates from the command staff.
Well, it has to.
But I mean, the question has, you can't duck the question. We watched the disparity in treatment in commissioners from Bats to Ham, and how Kevin Davis is being treated.
Yeah.
I still, in my mind, don't see where you should necessarily how we benefit as a city by firing him at this point.
No.
But at the same time, I understand clearly why people are saying, why not?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I think one of the things that I think is weird about Davis's tenure is that he had said, you know, he wants to put more officers in patrol. And most police you talk to say, yeah, you need to. And he emphasized that again today. But then he has like the district action teams, which is really just like a reiteration of the sort of VSET concept or model. So it's hard to tell if he's got a substantial direction. And a lot of these plans are the same thing. They're just, it's like a throw everything into the pot without sort of a decisive symbolic strategy. But I think on the other hand, Davis has been very personable. And he's been a pretty good ambassador for, you know,
sort of
calming the tensions and reaching out to the community, which really is what the commissioner has been tasked with doing since Freddie Gray. So, I mean, what are you going to do? Go hire another Norris to come in and be like, let's crack down? That's not going to go over.
That wouldn't be good.
It shows you the impossibility when a police department breaks down in its basic mission.
I think that's the point. The issue isn't necessarily who the commissioner is, you know?
Right.
I mean.
Yeah. What are you going to do? I mean, if you're not competent or, you know, you can't really change this department.
And I think that's why it's interesting that in City Councilman Brandon Scott's plan to reduce violence, one of the things that he mentions is taking some of the power away from the FOP, for example, with the scheduling. Right.
You're
now,
right. He wants to change that schedule.
He wants
right
to change
away.
The schedule. I think it's a 10-hour days, and he wants to change that because the change that occurred has actually led to more overtime for police officers, and supposedly officers are also more tired that this schedule
which
isn't working
exactly
for them either.
Which is exactly the opposite of how that was billed by Bats and Mayor Rawlings Blake, that it was going to reduce overtime and
be
better.
Yeah, it seems that it did the opposite. Yeah. So to take some of the power out of the hands of the FOP and put it back in charge of...
Let's talk about that a little bit. Brandon Scott was on Thursday, I think it was, he was on Thursday, talking about his plan. I didn't know that his plan was signed off on by him, not just him, but the entire Public Safety Committee.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which I think is interesting.
That is very interesting.
I said it when I interviewed him, and I'll say it again. His plan focuses more on people than it does on police.
Yes,
absolutely.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say I've taken a look at Mayor Pugh's 20-page plan and the Live to Be More plan by Councilman Scott, which is 37 pages. And I have to say, it really does seem like he has a very strong emphasis on using community-based organizations to do a lot of the heavy lifting. And one thing that he pointed out that, for example, I didn't see mentioned in Mayor Pugh's plan was a focus, for example, on truancy.
Yes.
And making sure that kids were actually getting into school, because there is evidence that shows that when a child misses a great deal of school, it directly affects their, you know, their everything from their literacy to their ability to get a job later in life. And it is a predictor of them being able to have a job that is legal and productive in our community. So getting kids on track with literacy, getting kids in school, there are just some, you know, some interesting things that were placed in there that if this holistic plan is used, I think it could actually have a really positive impact on Baltimore City, not just for the violence, but for the health of the community.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yost, your host. I'm in the studio with the Mod Squad. That's Taya Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. We're talking politics and law enforcement. Back to Brandon Scott for a minute. The fact that I didn't know this until you all just mentioned it. The fact that he wants to put some constraints, I guess is the word, on the FOP is very interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, the one of the top bullet lines, as Taya pointed out, was to immediately get the FOP out of the scheduling and take out the four on, three off schedule immediately. Like that was like the number one bullet point, and sort of get the FOP out of the management equation in the Baltimore City Police Department. And I think that's telling, because that's something the mayor has not, she has not been critical of the FOP. I mean, because one thing she said at a press conference, like, we can't change it because the FOP controls scheduling. And that's when I asked her the question, is the FOP running the city? And they're like, no, we're running the city. But that is very, you know, that is very telling, because I think to a certain extent, we don't know what really goes on inside the police department. We don't know really what's going on. I don't know if we really understand the dynamics of, you know, how policing is being prosecuted in the city and whether or not they have any strategy. It's very hard to tell. That's the big question, right?
Sure. I think what would be wonderful is that there is actually a merging of these two strategies. And instead of them being competing strategies, they could actually be conjoined. In Mayor Pugh's plan, now I didn't go through the fine-tooth comb, but there were aspects of her plan talking a lot about adding in technology, gathering data, making sure that agencies are communicating with each other, you know, things that are sensible. Councilman Brandon Scott's plan seems to really emphasize working with the youth, helping with getting civic engagement with young people.
And safe streets. So.
At safe streets, the cure violence model. Mm-hmm. There was a group violence reduction strategy. I think it's called Hoops, a basketball hoops program that he wants to get.
Midnight Hoops.
Thank you so much. Yeah. The Midnight Hoops program that he wanted to get more money towards, to build it, to grow it. So there was a lot of focus on youth for violence prevention that looks really positive.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense. It's logical. Yeah, let's take some phone calls. Let's take a few phone calls, and then we'll talk more. Let's go to John in Ellicott City. John, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Okay, I'll be very, very brief. Although I live in Ellicott City, I grew up in Baltimore. I have a lot of family in Baltimore, and I spend a lot of time in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
But as we all know, that when you head up an organization, I once headed up, and I worked up in our division. You're paid more than the subordinates, and when things go awry, it's the head that usually goes.
Mm-hmm.
And if Davis has lost the confidence, and most people I know, he has lost the confidence of the community, that needs to go. And I agree with your guess that you know, and I heard Councilman
Brandon Scott,
yeah, the other day. And he basically says he doesn't want his plan to be standalone. He wants to merge it with the mayor, as your guest said. And I also believe there should be some community involvement. But they need to go back to the table. And you can't have a union controlling the scheduling. I don't know whether that's in the contract or whether by law.
Mm.
But to me, that makes no sense at all.
John, thank you for your comment.
Davis, you know, he needs to go. People need to be a fresh look at all of this mess.
All right, John, thank you for
you. Bye-bye.
Thank you for your comment. Appreciate it. Tyrone Powers had the People's Plan.
Yes.
And that drew on a lot of community input,
sure
I believe.
Did.
It was very much similar. In fact, there's a lot of echoes because actually Tay is an expert on the People's Plan.
Well, I wouldn't call myself an expert, but I did my best to
That was like the turning point in the city when it was like zero tolerance or community-based policing and Sergeant Lewis Hobson and Tyrone Powers and, you know, the city.
And Doc Cheatham and other members of Black Academia and Intelligentsia.
We know which way it went.
Yeah, and then they actually present this to O'Malley, and
they brought the whole council down to Richmond to show them some of the programs they were working on in Richmond, and had a big bus go down there and everything. Yeah. So, but O'Malley was going up to New York, right?
Yeah, going to get his fellas.
So instead of getting the wisdom from the community
down here to bust some skulls. So that was a very
remember what happened when Ron Daniels was put into the chair?
He wouldn't do it.
Well, O'Malley put a plan in front of him and this is what you're going to do.
And
Daniel said 57 days later he was out.
Yep. Because he wouldn't do it.
Right.
He wouldn't do zero tolerance. Yeah.
You've got to respect his choice to say no to that.
Because obviously that's a disaster from which we're still kind of...
The community's still reeling from it.
I think so.
There's no doubt about it. Let's go to Ernest next. Ernest, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
How you doing?
All right.
First of all, I want to just send a message to... Professor Doug Colbert.
Okay.
Professor Colbert, if you're still listening, look up the article of Peter Herman on Sergeant Hobson, Sharon May, and Judge Gordy.
All right.
And is that we knew about, first of all, Batts appointed got Kevin Davis in this police department and put him second in charge, coming from.
Okay.
Now, everybody knew about Kevin Davis. The city paper did an article on him. It was, I think, the Washington Post had an article on him, where he had kidnapped a 19-year-old boy and took him out of the district where he was working and roughed him up, assaulted him, and things like this. And he had to pay a certain amount of money. Kevin Davis was sued twice. However, just like I think it's because he was white, the city council didn't do their
due diligence
and hired him anyway.
All right.
As police commissioner, after people were saying, wait a minute, don't make him a police commissioner. Let him be intern until you do a thorough investigation.
Right.
Now, if you fire Kevin Davis, you fire him, you still are going to have to pay him.
Right. Ernest, we got to keep moving. We don't have a lot of time left, but thank you for your comment. Let's go to Nicole in Towson. Nicole, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Great. How's everybody? Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you.
Thank you. You know, I think I remember the reason why Kevin Davis hasn't been fired is because when he was signing on, I remember... I don't know if it was the FOP or someone kept saying, you know, give him a contract, you know, and they were saying a guaranteed contract. So I don't know if he's guaranteed like 3 years or however
6 years. It was a 6-year contract. I don't know how much of it's guaranteed, but he has a 6-year contract with the city.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I do remember, you know, Anthony Batts didn't have that. He didn't have, like, guaranteed time and that he could not be fired. And I think that's why Kevin Davis hasn't been fired, is because he signed some contract that has provisions that say, you know, you cannot fire this man until, you know, such a time, you know, frame has been.
I think he can be fired, but I think he gets a payout. I think that's how the contract was structured. But it's, yeah, I mean, that might be part of it. Just
I think it's a significant
payout,
and it's a significant observation. As far as the disparity between the contract that Batts received and the contract that Kevin Davis received.
Absolutely.
Nicole,
absolutely.
Thank you for
absolutely.
That. And
good point.
When you look at Anthony Batts' background, he ran a big city police department in Oakland, right?
Oakland, yep, and Long Beach, California.
Kevin Davis
Oakland.
Never did.
No. He ran Anne Arundel County.
Right.
But he was there for PG County's consent decree, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the educational background of Batts, there's definitely a disparity
in
his favor.
But let's remember, the most successful police commissioner only had a GED, and that would have been
BFL'd,
yeah.
I'm just saying, when it comes down to the contract
successful?
And the money.
Come on, Sean, policing's not about thinking.
No,
all right?
Well, maybe not. Let me go.
Oh, I do.
Let me go. Let me go to Oscar next. Oscar, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Good evening.
Hey, Oscar.
Good evening, okay. Oscar.
Good evening.
Let me try this for a change.
Uh-huh.
Y'all don't like to do.
Okay.
When Ron Daniels, 53 days, O'Malley wasn't the mayor. Kurt Smoke was.
All right.
Crazy. O'Malley arrested everybody.
I mean, but seriously, I mean, you didn't say anything.
All right.
And all the commissioners get this. Then y'all bring up the fact that if Doc Cheatham wasn't opposed to zero tolerance, he's calling for that right now as we speak.
All right.
No, that's not true. I mean, I covered Doc Cheatham during the zero tolerance, and he was one of the few people that protested.
Told Davis and the police department they sell drugs from Bedlow North all the way down to North and Pennsylvania.
They are, Oscar.
But I mean, Oscar, why is that fun? Why are you making fun of him for speaking out? I mean, what? That's kind of weird.
Shouldn't he be saying that, Oscar?
Yeah.
I'm just speaking the truth. And all please, right. I told you before, nobody on this planet can tell me how to talk. No one.
All right, Oscar.
I slapped to St. Peter. Nobody tell me how to talk. I said Doc Cheatham is calling for zero tolerance now.
All right, Oscar. And I'm not going to try to tell you how to talk.
Thank you. Even St. Peter can't tell him how to talk.
That's fine. Let's take one more quick call. Let me go to Thomas in Churchville. Thomas, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Sean, Mod Squad. How you guys doing?
We are.
Hi. Hey, how you doing?
Good to hear from you.
I got a homework assignment for y'all.
Uh-oh. Okay.
I heard Brandon Scott on the other day was saying that they can't fire the police or they can't determine who's in the police department.
City council can't.
Isn't city council always vetted the police commissioner or vote whether they give him a contract or not?
Yeah, he has to be approved. Absolutely, that's true.
And Brandon did say specifically. Brandon did say specifically that he did not want Kevin Davis to be the next police commissioner.
No. He didn't say that. But he was saying that the city council can't determine who's in or who's out of the police department.
As far as firing, yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
That is not true. My squad, in the state of Maryland, which Baltimore City is a part of, and in the police department, a part of a state agency or a city agency?
It's a state agency. That's right.
So therefore, in the police department falls under a at-will state, in the state of Maryland, an at-will state to work?
No, they've got a union contract. I mean, no, you can't.
No. Whether you have unions or not, the state of Maryland is a at-will state.
All right, that's Thomas, true. We got to keep moving. We're literally out of time. To my knowledge, the Baltimore City Council can't do it. They can't do it.
No.
No, I think they're incredibly limited in what they can do with the police department.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
I mean, no.
All they can do is approve funds too. They can't even cut funds from the police department, right?
No, they can cut funds.
They can cut.
They can cut funds, but then the mayor can just put them wherever she wants. So,
okay, yeah. So it's a wash.
It's a wash. Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot they can do.
The Mod Squad is Ted Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. Friends, good to see you. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Have a good weekend.
Yeah. Yes.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the second hour of First Edition, the world famous happy hour, is the Supernova and the Volcano, Navasha Dea and Lafayette Gilchrist together in the world famous. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.